Hello and welcome to another episode of the State of the Arts podcast. This is a really special episode, not least because we're getting to share it on the radio waves. This discussion kicks off a new digital exhibition series from the State of the Arts, in which we're going to explore various music scenes from the north of England that have had a huge impact but have been historically overlooked. We're starting with the jazz funk scene of the late 70s and early 80s that gripped the north of England and attracted diverse audiences of thousands who'd be up all night dancing to a particular high tempo, intelligent genre of funk music. Despite its popularity at the time, not a lot has been written about the jazz funk years, and ensuing scenes like rave and Manchester are much better documented and celebrated. But without jazz funk before it, these scenes would never have been so big. And to help us better understand this moment in music history, we've enlisted three of the key DJs that carried the scene. We've got Colin Curtis, Mike Shaft, and Greg Wilson, who kindly guided us through the details of the jazz funk era. From the origins of the scene to some of the key record stores and clubs and radio stations that hosted the jazz funk sound, we talked about all the factors that made this scene so significant. This conversation was recorded at Reform Radio Station in Manchester, and we're delighted that Reform could host us and play us out on the radio afterwards. We hope you enjoy the discussion and the tracks, and that you get a bit more of an appreciation of the jazz funk scene and why it was such a huge moment in the history of British music. Thanks a lot, guys. Very excited to have this chat. Obviously, you guys, you know more about this subject than everyone. It usually makes sense to start at the beginning when we talk about these kinds of things, but maybe we should start before the beginning and look at the period before the 1980s and get a sense of what Manchester was like, what clubbing was like in Manchester, what partying was like in the UK as well. Colin, I know you were involved in, you know, the Northern Soul scene in the 70s, so do you want to paint a bit of a picture of what it was like in the world just before jazz funk landed?
Well, I moved into, shall we say, what became later known as the Northern Soul scene. It was just a bunch of enthusiastic underground people, and Manchester's connection was the Twisted Wheel. The Twisted Wheel provided the soundtrack really for our lives during that period. The music was coming out the 60s, what had moved on from what was termed back then as R&B, not to be confused with the R&B in the 90s, but 60s R&B, and then the solid foundation of Tamla Motown actually created lots of copycats, copycat labels, copycats, artists all over America. Most of which were failures in terms of chart hits on Billboard and great success in America. 60s was still very much about live bands and clubs. DJs were still secondary. But this background of music that was evolving from the Twisted Wheel at this time just, you know, took us by storm, and we were hooked and remained hooked to black music ever since.
And that period then in the 70s, just before we get into the 80s, which I guess is depicted as the jazz funk era, what was going out like? You know, what were the crowds like, and where were they sort of going? In which, was it just Manchester? Was it across the UK?
No, I mean, at this time, I signed to Mecca in 1967 to do, well, a regular DJ on the main floor, and then I would go downstairs and play soul on a Thursday, and then they gave me a Sunday night as well for soul. So on a Sunday, I'm getting 400 or 500 people in playing again what is now Northern Soul, but at the time was just an underground scene. In Manchester, really, by this time, you know, the black music scene, from my perspective, was kind of established, and so that would take us through to the mid 70s, and then we bring in Manchester Ritz. You know, Manchester Ritz at that time, again, you know, similar artists. We had Gloria Barnes, who was accompanied by Mark Bolan at that point.
Yeah.
So the Northern Soul All Dayers started probably around 74 in Manchester at the Ritz, and pulling in, you know, maybe 1,000 people or in excess. But as the music changed, that became probably the most catalytic place in the North. This combination of people who were into Northern Soul and people who were getting into what became, again, after the event, jazz funk.
Mm.
So, you know, we've got 1,500 people, and it was like almost a changing of the guards when the DJ changed from Northern Soul to what would be termed jazz funk. And we went from the, you know, the baggy trousers and the T-shirts to Hawaiian shirts and plastic sandals and whistles. It really was a pot pourri of excitement and change.
Yeah.
Not all accepted by everybody.
Of course. Mike, you came into it through having radio and DJ sets, right? So you were a really integral figure with the Piccadilly radio station, and your show was really popular. Could you talk a little bit about how you kind of got involved with DJing and being in the scene at that time, and also what you were doing to promote this style of music?
Well, my story is very different to Colin's. I'll hold my hands up there. I came to this country in 68 and attended school here and then started work in the post office. And when I was going out, there was a club. It was a bar, not a club. Next to the Palace Theatre. I can't remember the name of it. And we'd go there at 11 o'clock, they'd throw us out, which was fine. And one day, one night, all the guys said, we're going to Explosion. I'd never even heard of Explosion. So I said, oh yeah, I'll come along. We get there, and Explosion is a club downstairs. You walk in, it's totally dark, and it is rammed. I would say 90% black people. And the music is just awesome. James Brown, the JBs, that kind of stuff. Mm. And the groove is just, you know, that all night long. And it was wonderful. And I loved that, played that to myself. I remember I was living in Wally Range at the time. On a Sunday morning, I'd put the speakers on the balcony and play to the whole street and anybody else who wanted to hear it. The guy opposite hated me because he usually got in, you know, about 3-4 o'clock in the morning after he'd been partying. And then there's me at 8 o'clock whooping it up. So it was a very interesting time. There were some great record shops. One of the best was Robinson's Records.
Correct.
Which brought in by the truckloads all of these American artists. And you'd see Stevie Wonder and whoever else, all there, really reasonably priced. And I started my collection there. Eventually, of course, the record shops turned into Spin In.
Yeah.
And that was just amazing. No other word for it. A tiny shop. The whole of the shop was probably this size.
Six
of the
people
studio.
When it was full.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And no, the space between the wall behind the till, that's it. And, you know, two or three people serving, and then just a little bit more for the punters. And they'd be queuing outside on a Saturday.
Was a meeting place on a Saturday.
Absolutely.
It was a feeding frenzy once they started stocking imports. And they started stocking imports, actually, in 1970, around that time, that early.
Yeah.
I first came across the shop around that time, and I found it because at that time, opposite Spinning was this fantastic cake shop. And That was almost equally interesting to me at the time. I've no idea why, but that it was the cake shop that drew me back there. But as early as 1970. But it's quite funny because Northern Soul got its name, you know, simply because it was played in the north of England, not because it was from North America or North Detroit. It was geographically it was played in the north of England, and jazz funk had no name. I think in the early days, in fact, I came to Manchester in 78, but John Grant and I used to sit there and we'd put funk first, or don't put jazz there, nobody will come if you put jazz, so put soul, and you know, we were kind of feeling a way around, so. And if we move on a little bit to where we started to play house music, at that time, is it garage? Is it warehouse? Yeah. Is it shed? Yeah. What is it? You know, but all that, and Greg's got his own story of innovation, but all these things were happening in Manchester, but not because they didn't happen anywhere else, they absolutely did. But Manchester was a unique story.
Mm.
Can I just jump in here and what Colin was saying about the Mecca and everything?
Of course,
one thing
yeah.
that would probably add context to this is that the difference between the Blackpool Mecca and Wigan Casino, which is obviously the hallowed Northern Soul venue, the Mecca opened at normal club hours, closed at 2 o'clock. The casino opened at 2 o'clock and run till eight in the morning. So there was this, even this last hour of the Mecca, when a lot of people were heading over to the casino, where Colin and Ian Levine were more experimental. But the big difference was what they did at the Mecca were basically like seen as heretics for it, was they began to play contemporary music as opposed to 60s oldies. And that's changed. So by 76 in the Mecca, you would be playing a lot of what was then termed New York disco.
Mm. If you want to pick on a crucial record, then it has to be Gil Scott-Heron, because
that
was Gil Scott-Heron changed everything, absolutely everything. I think Mike's is, a musically different story, but equally interesting and equally poignant. I mean, Mike would be the last person to say this, but Mike's radio show was the most important radio show that's ever happened to black music in Manchester. That is a fact. I mean, you came in after Andy Peebles. Mm. Which was at the time considered to be big shoes to fill. Andy Peebles, Robbie Vincent, all these names were thrown around. But you came in at that point and you owned that show.
Well, let me tell you, I mean, it goes further back for me, because when they said, they announced there was going to be a radio station in Manchester, my letter went in straight away. I just wanted that job. I didn't get it. Colin Walters wrote me back and said, thanks very much, or his secretary did, but we don't need a black music DJ. And on the first Friday, the station launched on the Monday, and the first Friday, I think it was the first soul show.
Mm.
So I'm there, 7, 8 o'clock, whatever time it was. Andy Peebles comes on and is magnificent. And I knew then I would never work at Piccadilly while Andy Peebles was there. I just knew it. His show was excellent.
Was it very smooth soul, or was it...
Well, he loved Bobby Womack, for instance.
Right, okay.
And that quality, it's didn't do a lot of Northern soul,
didn't do a lot of
funk. Mm. It was middle of the road. But then along comes me. And
amazing.
Andy Peebles was great. But I spoke to him must be a couple of years ago. And he says, you know what the difference between you and me is, Mike? I would never have played One Nation Under a Groove by Funkadelic.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Right? He says, once he heard that on the radio, he knew people would forget about Andy Peebles.
So that's something I really want to sort of dig into, this kind of transition in the type of funk and the type of soul and the type of jazz that's being heard at this time.
I mean, what Mike did, the difference between what he was doing and what Peebles was doing was Mike brought what was happening in the clubs onto the radio. It was very much a club-based show, although you still did a lot of soulful stuff as well. And that, it's almost like the forerunner to Kiss FM and all these things that happened later. It was like one show once a week, but absolutely essential.
But I was playing this stuff every night in the clubs.
Yeah.
So I wasn't going to suddenly become somebody else.
Mm.
This is what I was playing. And in the end, I got all the people who were going to the clubs to listen to the show. But I just love the music. That's my stance. I love the music. And the stuff that had been played in Explosion, which was all that black music, James Brown, man, James Brown and the JBs for me were the ones. And they made music that I could dance to, that I could scream to. And I just got the crowd dancing to that stuff. And then along came the Commodores with Brick House.
That's right.
Massive. Bambara, you mentioned.
Well, yeah.
Massive. Brass Construction. Oh, yeah. My goodness.
Well, I mean that was the change. I mean, when you talk, I've mentioned at Blackpool Mecca the old days, and also the old days that we did at the Manchester Ritz. We went from booking people like Edwin Starr and Junior Walker to suddenly booking. We had Brass Construction live at Blackpool Mecca, the same time they were number one album all over the world. And then we moved on with Sylvester. We brought Players Association.
Roy Ayres.
We had Roy Ayres. Yeah, Roy Ayres, in fact, was 70. I think it was January 79, and it snowed that day. And we had to drag Roy Ayres off. In fact, at one point, we thought we were going to have to turn the electricity off to get him off.
Get off, yeah.
He wouldn't stop. It was incredible all day. But
can I just go back a second to that Brass Construction album? Because the influence of that album, people don't realise how massive... I mean, I think Blues and Soul call it the greatest funk album of all time. At the day. It was just huge. And also, with regards to the oncoming jazz funk era and the British jazz funk, I mean, both High Tension and Light of the World were well influenced by that Brass Construction
album.
Well,
High Tension played at Manchester Ritz at that time. We had High Tension at Manchester Ritz and Light of the World at Blackpool Mecca. They were massively influenced.
The mix of people is the other thing which needs talking about, because this music was supported by people of all colour, all colours. And they came and they danced and they partied, and those who smoked weed smoked weed, and then they went home.
And this was uniquely distinguished jazz funk from everything else that was going on at the time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because if you go back to Rafters, for instance, sorry, not Rafters, to Explosion, it was mainly a black club. If you went to any of the Northern Soul clubs, it was white. Mm.
You're right. I think... When I came to Rafters in 78, by 79, I would say the demographic of the crowd had probably changed to 60 to 70% black as opposed to white, because initially a lot of the Blackpool Mecca people followed me down, who'd come through the Northern Soul scene. And so there was that connection. Some people stayed, some people didn't. But generally, you're right, it was all creeds. I think the jazz funk thing became all-encompassing.
Absolutely.
Because also, as well as the clubs, through yourself, through Robbie Vincent, they could access this. And in those days, there wasn't 1,000 radio shows playing this black music. Everybody recorded Robbie Vincent, everybody recorded Mike.
Terry Linane
in Liverpool. That was the source of information for a lot of people. Mm. If you came to the club, then yes. But if you didn't come to the clubs, the information was still available. Mm.
It'd be good to play one of the tracks you've mentioned. I think we saw the Gil Scott Heron tune is in there somewhere. Are there any other songs that people think are really appropriate, given what we've already said about that early years of jazz funk?
One of the tracks I remember when it started to change, and I'd never heard anything this good. I don't know if I've heard anything this good since. I came down one night to Rafters and you guys were playing. Throwing lots of foam about, I remember, I think.
Thanks for that.
Never forget that. And on comes Come With Me by
Tanya Marie.
And I thought, this scene is going to happen.
Actually, one thing I really wanted to pick up was you guys referenced Legend earlier. I know there's going to be lots of different places and venues that were special for this time. But Legend seems to recurrently come up as something that was... particularly important to making this scene as memorable as it was. And I know, Greg, you were at Wigan, working Wigan Pier, and then you moved across to Legend. You'd probably be best placed to sort of tell us about what Legend was as a club, what made it special in terms of the audience, in terms of the space, why was it so important?
Okay. Well, I mean, firstly, my entry points, like Mike and Colin have given different entry points, was different again. I was... in Merseyside, my aspiration was to be a black music specialist, but I'd started off in normal clubs, and like everybody else, I had to pay my apprenticeship, I had to play the chart hits. But bit by bit, I managed to kind of impose my own personality. I eventually went out to work I'd worked in Europe in 78 on monthly contracts, and I went out again in 1980 to Germany. And it was while I was there that I landed the job at Wigan Pier through a friend of mine that I'd met 2 years earlier in Norway, who was the resident there at the time, and he was taking over Legend in Manchester. And so they needed a resident for Wigan Pier. And I managed to get that job on his recommendation. And the Pier was an amazing club. It was just so ahead of its time, the lighting, the sound system. It was just a different level to what was going on. And so I had the residency there 4 nights a week. The Tuesday night was the jazz funk night. So it was probably pulling in about 400 or 500 people. The club was about 1,000. You could cram in about 1,000 into it. But it was the jazz funk audience in the Northwest. You know, there was a lot of white kids in areas like St. Helens, Wigan, you know, Widnes, these areas that gravitated towards this music. And one of the things about jazz funk as well, and we were talking before about the Mecca and the Mecca playing what was called New York Disco, these tracks that were coming out, and we were just getting an idea of this New York thing that was going on. Mixing hadn't come into its own at the time. That would come into play later. So, you know, it was a time where we were kind of working it out, and the disco thing was massive. And in 70, late 77, I think it was 78, Saturday Night Fever landed. But it was so big that all of a sudden, everyone was into discos. There were disco dancing classes starting off. It just became crass and commercialised. And I think with what had been happening on the underground at the time, and these jazz-based funk records, Roy Ayres, Donald Byrd, Lonnie Liston Smith, Gil Scott-Heron, these things were coming out. So I think the DJs that were always looking for newer music, they were moving away from disco because it was getting a bit of a bad terminology through Saturday Night Fever. And this jazz funk sound,
it's more authentic. Or?
This was the cooler edge of things, if you want to call it that. And so that's where I was kind of gravitating. But Landing the Pier gave me the Tuesday night. I also took over the Wednesday at Legend. They'd started, it was the same company that owned the two clubs. They'd started their jazz funk night on a Wednesday. And I eventually went in there in late 81 to try and save the night, because it had been strong. John Grant, the DJ who worked with Colin, had worked there for a time. But then he'd left and he'd started a night with Mike that was Blues and Soul Piccadilly Radio promoted, called The Main Event, on a Tuesday night in Manchester, Placemate 7. And that had really dented into Legend's audience, and it was dropping and dropping. So by the time I got there, they were probably putting, you know, over 300 a week, and now it was below 100, and it was dying. And they just give me the chat, you know, can you salvage it? And it took a while, you know, I mean, but we gradually built it and things took off and it became what it was. So, you know, Legend was on the cusp of what was the jazz funk scene, but then moving into what became electro funk. That became the predominant music. I mean, I kind of date the jazz funk era probably 76, 77, 77, 82, 82 maybe. I think by the time 82 had come along, it was struggling to retain the quality of music. And that's around the time when Colin went into Berlin, and a small club took a Tuesday night there. And that was more the jazz dance side of things coming into play.
Change the rules, yeah. I mean, it was the first time that I know Ewan was there, but I mean, once I got there, I played for the rest of the night. It was the first time I'd done 4 and 5 hour sets.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I tried to encompass everything. The reason it did so much damage, I think, is there were so many influential people who came, you know, as well as Mike. And this one night, the bouncer came down to me and said, "I've got someone at the door, says, you said he can come in." I said, "Well, who is it?" He said, "I don't know, but he looks about 12. I said, "Oh, that'll be Giles." I said, "So you better let him in." Giles Peterson, this was, appearing in that club for the first time, because his best friend was at Manchester University. And I didn't know this at the time, but what his best friend, he would come up to me most nights at Berlin with a piece of paper. "Oh, what was that one? What was that one?" And then the next day he'd be ringing Giles and telling him what I was playing. But Giles had appeared for the first time in person. And I think what he took away, and what he says historically he took away from that, was this combination of all the styles of music being available. But the money spent on Wigan Pier and Legend was astronomical on sound system and lighting. Stuff we'd never seen before anywhere.
Well, back then, the only place anybody knew had that stuff was Studio 54 in...
No, that's right, in New York.
Right. And that's when I walked into Wigan Pier the first time, I was blown away. Yeah. I'd come from clubs, dark, dingy, always downstairs. And you walk into this place and it was like, wow, the lighting. Oh, my
Can you guys describe a bit what it looks like and who's there and what they're doing? And, you know, clearly dancing is a huge part of this moment, right?
Well, the balcony. was a cool place to be because you just you overlooked the dance floor, so you saw everything that was going on there, and people would think, you know, should I go down? You know, I wonder if I could do that. You know, and in the end, pile on the dance floor, and your favorite track will come on at some point in time.
And the DJ was in a frog, in a huge frog.
Fiberglass frog.
and this is a time when, you know, dancing is actually a very important performative part of going out, right? It's not raving, and it's
life and death for these kids.
It was essential. Mm. I mean, to the extent whereby you could have a kid with no prospects, no money, life looks bad for them, walking the streets of Moss Side, but as they walk down the streets, other people nod at them. Mm. And they're nodding at them because they can dance. Mm. So they're somebody. So the level of intensity of the dance, it's not like anything now when we talk about dancing. It was really serious.
It was an extension of what I saw at Birmingham with maybe 10, 15 dancers. The extension became individuality remained in place. The enthusiasm and passion remained in place. And this became, I remember talking to some kid, I think it was probably on the way back from a night at Wigan Pier. He wanted to lift back to Keel Services, and then he said he'd get back to Birmingham from there. But I said, well, what are you thinking of doing with your life? And he said, oh, I'll just be dancing all my life. You know, that was it. That in a nutshell, that was what was important. I mean, you played as well, but I mean, I played the Repercussion Festival recently in Manchester, and lots of young kids, young enough to be my grandchildren, really. And, it was just everybody standing there with a telephone. Dancing is not the most important. Yeah. Shaking about a bit and waving your arms a bit and thinking you're on the telly, you're on the ballroom, whatever. But I'm not taking anything away from these people. It was just a completely different approach.
To music. A good example is when rave eventually happened at the Hacienda in '88. The house music crowd was already in place, and it was a predominantly black crowd that brought that music into the Hacienda. People like a guy called Gerald and Foot Patrol, the famous kind of crew, they brought that style into the Hacienda. But when we get the footage post-88, where are the black kids? They're not there. Yeah. And the reason they're not there is because when they went to the Hacienda, it wasn't ram-packed. And it's a big place. They had loads of dancing space. They loved the fact that they had dancing space. So when it becomes packed and everyone's crammed in and doing big fish, little fish, and it's just hand movements and moving their hips, there's no floor space. These guys want to use their legs and go. And that is when the black crowd gravitated away from the Hacienda. So that lineage was lost when the people who were documenting rave first came in. A lot of them weren't previously into dance music. They might have been into indie or stuff, and they'd taken a pill, and now this dance music was great. And they saw this brand new scene, and they thought that it had been brought back from Ibiza or something. Yeah. And the whole connection with the black scene, which was a direct lineage to that Hacienda moment, was lost.
Yeah.
And so many things that were written without that in there, and this complete disconnect. So at basis, rave was all about, you know, what had been brought into play by that black music underground beforehand, what had been brought into the Hacienda. I started working there in 1983, which brought the crowd from Legend across, although it didn't ultimately work at that moment in time. They kept the Friday night on. That became Nude Night with Mike Pickering. And that was what eventually blew up. And it was this kind of trajectory out of the black. I mean, that's what people think again with the Hacienda, you know, 88 explodes, but they had a big night with Nude from 86 onwards.
And let's not forget that Ewan Clark, you know, a black DJ.
He was the first DJ in the Hacienda.
And I think, you know, he was part of the attraction for those kids going there as well, because Ewan was picking up what was happening, obviously, in Berlin. All around. He was very musically aware.
Well, the perfect example there is Klein and MBO Dirty Talk, the Italian track, which went massive at Legend. And Harry Taylor, when I used to go in spinning, obviously he dealt with the gay side of the shop. Apart from the black music side, there was a huge kind of buying loads of Euro tracks for the DJs on the gay scene and everything. But Harry was aware that I was getting into this new electronic sound. And he pulled things out for me. And he pulled out this Klein and MBO on an Italian label called Zanza. And that just blew up, went massive at Legend. And then Hewin picked a copy up. I think his copy's on Siamese. It's on a different label. It's not on the Italian original. But he played that at the Hacienda. And one night, New Order were in there, and they heard it, and they asked if they could borrow it. And they were working on a track, which was Blue Monday. It became a template for Blue Monday, you know.
Going back to the radio, all these scenes were going on in Manchester, in Wigan, in Liverpool, and all this is going on in the clubs. And I'm thinking to myself, I've got to get this on the radio. Now, I'm not interested in electro music, but I know somebody who is. So we get Greg in. We get Colin in to do his jazz break. Mm. Dave Everson came in and did Northern Soul.
Yes.
I'm quite happy to give 15 minutes of my show to any, because I know there were people listening who were interested in that.
Yes.
And the jazz folk tuned in religiously for that jazz break.
Yes.
That was their 15 minutes of reverse fame.
Yeah.
You know?
Cool.
And again, you know, point out, we've kind of touched on it with things, but although it was, say, at one point we called it jazz funk, what I was doing later, we called it electro funk. It wasn't just one way.
Yeah,
it wasn't all jazz funk. There was soul tracks. There was kind of what were now termed boogie tracks.
Yeah, yeah.
Played. Jazz funk was the predominant strain, like electro funk. So even at the peak of electro, when I was playing it in 83, I was still at Legend. I was still doing two jazz breaks a night.
Yes.
There was enough jazz dancers coming down, so three records.
Well, you saw that. I mean, I don't think you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think jazz was part of your itinerary when you came into it, to the extent that I took it. But it was great for me to come to Legend and to come to Wigan and see you doing that and seeing the reaction that got. But that was it. I mean, it had got to a point, and both these guys have experienced this as well. The most essential part of any club night is the trust between the DJ and the dancers at this point. And, you know, these guys produce. And I always think, if this working to this level, let's push.
We've touched on that kind of sound as it's veering away from that more recognisable jazz funk sound. It might be good to play some songs that kind of indicate it.
I mean, obviously, the whole British jazz funk thing came alive. You know, there was just high tension, like the world, this whole British jazz funk scene emerged. Now, there's one really important track from originally released in 1980, but then a different version came out in 81, which was a British release. At the time, it was played as a jazz funk track. That's how we saw it. And it was the TW Funkmasters, Love Money. It was a guy called Tony Williams, who was a radio DJ on Radio London playing reggae. And he decided, he was a club DJ, also he worked on Fubert's on Carnaby Street. And he wanted to make, Rapper's Delight was out, he wanted to make a rap record. And he brought into play Dennis Brown's Money in My Pocket as a reference. And he made this strange record called Love Money, which was amazing. And the other side, the main side, was called Money No Love, which to my knowledge is the first example of a British rap record. But it was all Jamaicans that were making, so they're all reggae musicians. So it was a hybrid track. It sound, and it was massive on our scene, but it was an underground track. It was, you know, nobody outside of the scene knew it. But years later, I realised that it was a hugely important track in New York. It was played by Levan, Mancuso, all these. But Francois Kevorkian, I did a panel with him at the ICA in London about editing and everything. We were talking and I mentioned this track. And then he was talking about how he got into dub. I thought he was going to say Lee Scratch Perry, King Tubby, that whole thing. And he was like, Love Money, TW Funkmasters. He said, what you've just been talking about.
You've touched on the spinning, but it'd be good to dive into like what exactly was it like going to the spinning. I know that you were going there.
I mean, in those days, man, you had to, your best friend had to be the guy behind that counter.
Yeah. I think another thing that, you know, you couldn't just be a jazz funk DJ specialist.
Yeah, yeah.
You couldn't just turn up and say, I am, buy all the records even. There was a whole apprenticeship almost that you had to go through to get into, you had to get on the all-dayers for a start.
Yeah.
You know, there was a whole thing. So, you know, this was a very specialist cusp end of things. There was loads of DJs who would have loved to have been jazz
funk
specialists.
But Kevin took a dislike to you at spinning, you didn't get the best tunes.
No, well, he did that with me.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what track it was, Arthur Adams, You Got the Floor. Mm. He held it back from me. And I didn't know anything about it. Like the first week, somebody comes in, legend on a Wednesday, but Arthur Adams, You Got the Floor. Don't know it. Yeah. Oh, it was massive last night, the main event. So I'm like, I've got to get that. So I'm on the phone the next day. Oh, we had them in, but they've gone out. We'll have them in at the weekend.
It didn't come
back. Didn't come. No, it didn't get a copy. And the next week...
To be fair, that wasn't entirely down to Kev. That, because it was a small label thing, it had actually come from a different distributor. Yep. And nobody knew that until Garfield Fleming suffered the same fate. Yeah. I mean, that appeared and then disappeared.
But what happened, what made it... took it over the edge for me was the next Wednesday I'm in Legend, the fucking biggest track that you're playing on a Tuesday night, I haven't got a copy of it because I've been to spin, we haven't had it through yet. And so some lad comes up, can you play Arthur Adams? I haven't got it. Oh, I've got a copy in the car.
Wow.
And I went mad. So I went in, I went straight to Gary Lane. I spoke to Terry Lennon first because they were buying records as well from the pier. So they were spending 100 quid a week. Yeah. I was spending my money. And I went to Gary, I said, this can't happen.
Yeah.
I cannot not have the biggest track on the tune, and he totally agreed.
Because you're selling records for the shop. I mean,
this is it.
That's what these were. These were the weekly lists that we used to produce at Rafters of the tracks that we were playing. But if you went into spinning on a Monday, somebody'd be standing at the
with
counter
that list.
With the list,
and it was like a Chinese restaurant. I need a 7, 11, 16, and 14 with chips.
That was it.
And we would reference spinning in the write-ups at the bottom, and then there'd be like a top 10 oldies, and any information about old days would go on at the bottom as well. But this became the menu to buy records and spinning. Yeah.
I went to the shop because I got this tape from America, had this one bad habit on. I didn't have the track. I go to the shop, I say, Kevin, I want you to order me this track, this album from the States, and I advise you to buy every copy you can, because this is going to be massive.
Yeah.
And they must have sold hundreds.
I've heard that the spin-in was, you know, where you guys or where one would find out everything that they needed to about what was coming in, play it out, and then you would go and request more.
You've got to take into account, shops like spin-in were very rare. There were a few in the country. You know, in London, there was like Contempo owned by Blues and Soul, like Groove Records, City Sounds. But these were import specialists. Gary Lane, who owned the shop, had been around since the 60s.
I was going to say, they were way before any of those other shops.
They were pulling in imports from the 60s. Yep. And then the shop opened up. So,
can you guys describe the space a bit? So it's a record store somewhere in Manchester. Where was it?
It's on Cross Street. On Cross Street. Cool. And it was...
the back door of
it was literally two steps down. As you went down the two steps or three steps to get into the shop, on the left-hand side was a club called Talk of the Town, which
went on to be Hell,
where Gary Lane originally used to DJ, which also became Hell. It became what else did it become?
Playpen.
It was Bertie's. I know that for a while.
Smarties on a Sunday, because Smarties on a Sunday night was. I remember Frank Worthington, the England footballer, coming into me with and under his arm. He said, "I came last week." He said, "I heard you playing some jazz." He said, "I brought you some Art Pepper album."
What?
This is I said, "Never mind that. Just concentrate on scoring goals for England. Leave the music to me."
For Bolton as well.
But I will take the Art Peppers. Thank you. So this club was right next to Spinner, but Spinning, literally, if there were six or eight people in the shop, it was full. And as Mike says, this was the space for customers. That was the counter, which was quite high. There was two racks of albums there. There was some albums behind you on this. So it really was six or eight people in the shop. Everybody else at the top of the steps was like a congregation of people who were coming to, you know, to learn
church.
Their tunes. And because of these influential clubs that we've all been involved in, other DJs would come in from Bolton or from any of the greater Manchester area and through Mike's show as well, to come in to buy records at Spinning.
And these are imports that weren't available in other shops.
That's
these
right. There was no. I mean, my round would be, if I came up here with whatever money I got to spend, I would start in Spinning Records. Mm. And you've got people behind the counter, characters really, like Kev Edwards, like Harry Taylor, you know, big characters. And you know, you needed to keep on the right side of them, as you say. But then I would go to Virgin, I would go to HMV, and then I would go to the most magical shop that's ever been in Manchester for records, and that was Robinson's. I mean, this shop was on two floors, and they had soul, they had jazz, they had everything. In fact, I bought 7 Quartet Trebian albums from there in one hit when I first heard that track, Boss Trebian. And this was in the Berlin years. But before that, if you went in, all the records were in dividers. I remember, you know, because I'd started playing Roy Ayres, the Running Away album, Lifeline album at Blackpool Mecca. So that would be, what, about 77?
Yeah.
But then to find out about Virgo Red, to find out about Red, Black and Green. And of course, Spinning was a new music shop, so they weren't in there. But in Robinson's, the Roy Ayres section was 20 records deep. And on the dividers, on the cardboard dividers, was the date the records had come in, the date the copies had sold. It was a computer system, handwritten.
Yeah. Were you guys almost like marketing tools for these stores? Because after you played either a club night or a radio show, people would find out what the track was.
That's how it worked out with Spinning, really. You know, ultimately, if Spinning only got a few copies, then Mike Shaft had to have one, because if he played it on the radio, they stood to sell a load of copies.
Yeah.
Colin Curtis had to have one because of the gigs that he was doing. Eventually, I came into that and they bagged up these records for us. So we had first dibs on them before they went on a kind of more general sale. So there's a pecking order within Spinning, even, you know, like who got the records.
But can I say, they also sold us some crap.
Well, they tried to.
They just put it in the bag. Mike, you must have this. You must have this.
When you got home as well, there would always be records in your bag that you'd actually refused. When you listened on the deck when they played, you'd say, no, leave that. Yeah. But Gary would be behind the scenes sticking them in your bag anyway.
I was just going to ask, there's probably no way of quantifying this, but commercially, if you're taking tracks from the US and then bringing them here or wherever you're getting the imports, and then loads of people are buying them, like, you must be boosting the scene in a long term, because more people are going to be investing.
You're breaking records.
Right? Let me say this, right? And this is one of the things that I hated about the scene, cover-ups. Do you know what a cover-up is?
This is when you don't reveal who the artist
exactly.
is.
Exactly. Right? I don't know how much money artists missed out on because of cover-ups.
Mm.
And a few DJs, some of whom are still around now, who should be ashamed of themselves. When I was on the radio, even now when I'm on the radio, and I'm on the radio every day, right? I say the track and I say the album and I say the artist. Because if people hear it and they like it, they go and buy it. And eventually some money goes back to the artist.
Yeah.
These cover-ups were appalling. I'll never forgive DJs.
I guess what you're saying about being the conduit, really, and almost a salesperson, whether it was the radio. I mean, there was Mike, there was Robbie Vincent, that had huge power on the radio in terms of selling music, and in all our eras, whether it was me, whether it was Greg, whether it was some of the other top DJs from up and down the country, John Grant, it was very much the salesperson. You were, and therefore, because imports were still a fairly new thing for a lot of record shops. As Greg said earlier as well, only a handful of record shops existed that sold imports. So, people, whether it was Bluebird in London, whether it was Groove in London, up here it was Spinning, in Birmingham it was Graham Waugh. It was just essential. This was the only place you could get them. So you could sell hundreds of copies of a record on import that would not get counted for the national charts, although some of them would have national charted on some of the figures that were sold.
Does that feel like...
It was a massive impulse.
I mean, how the scene worked was that the club promotions people in the London departments were watching very closely what the DJs on this scene, the upfront scene, was playing to either license in tracks for British release or if it fell under one of their labels. We were the first port of call. I mean, these records were coming in from America, so Spinning was first point of contact. There might be other shops knocking about. There was a shop in Liverpool called Shevertons that sold imports, but what they were doing was buying their imports from Spinning, so they were second degree. spinning. You had to be there
because they were going to. I've just been reminded in my own head of probably one of the biggest records, and Mike would have been part of this as well. This album still goes for over £300 or £400 as an original, but Nightlife by Blair,
okay,
yeah, which became an anthem because of the combination of being played on the radio and in the clubs. And what Mike did with radio tracks that he's talked about before on a slower tempo is people accepted them in clubs after they'd been broken on the radio because they yes. and then we were able to play those tracks. But Blair Nightlife stood out because it was the classic jazz funk album that has remained, you know, a rare piece, you know, for all these years. But that was also caught up in those early weeks. I mean, I think Spinning had 4 to 5 copies. And then there was a big gap before any more turned up. And eventually, I think, if I went through these charts meticulously, it was number one for about 9 or 10 weeks. It had that level of impact for a track that was on the down low. Yeah. And that opened the door for Jones Girls. It opened the door for so many other down-tempo tracks.
Can I just ask quickly, guys? I mean, as DJs, you know, you've got lots of different responsibilities. Are you aware of all of those responsibilities as well in terms of, you know, you're trying to give people, make people have a good time? As you said, someone you brought you into Legend to help salvage the club. Well, I mean, are you aware of also the commercial benefit and the reach benefits you're having for the artists that you're playing? Like, are you thinking of all of these different roles and responsibilities you have in what I imagine feels like, you know, the most fun job?
I just think we were all like wanting to play great music as quickly as we could. You know, this is why there was no cover-ups on this scene, because there was always next week. I remember Les Spain, again, going back to the timepiece, and something that really impressed me. I mean, I'm 16 watching him, and he's this huge kind of larger-than-life figure. It's an all-nighter. All the DJs from Liverpool are there. They're all round his booth, and they've all got taking. And he's so gracious, he'll tell them everything. Yeah. And the reason being is he knows next week he's going to have a load more tunes.
He still does that. And I think, you know, the jazz funk era spawned more great tunes every week than any other era. Tunes that have stood the test of time.
Absolutely.
Classic tunes, whether it be the jazz side of it, the soul side of it, or the funk side of it. So much has been based on that 1977 to 83 is incredible. And even now, when you go out and buy edits and edits and edits and edits of records on 12, so many of them are going back to that period. Mm. Another one would be Ronnie Harris, 6 Million Steps. Yep. Another Ritz Monster.
But the thing is, Colin, that if we, the DJs, didn't have the knowledge to pick out those tracks, it would not have happened.
Not in the same way, no, absolutely not.
It would not have happened. Because an album comes out and there may be one track on it. Jun Yamaguchi, I can't even remember the name.
Yeah,
right.
That was the Womack track.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah. One track featuring Bobby Womack on vocals.
On an obscure Japanese album.
£20 you paid for a Japanese import in those days. Yeah. £20!
That was 2 weeks' wages for me.
Yeah, adjusted for inflation.
But you had to have it.
But don't forget also, with DJs, there is an egotistical side as well, in the sense that what Greg says is right. You want to play good music, but you also want to create your own aura, your own sound, sometimes not intentionally, but you do that.
I just want to pick on that, because it's an interesting point that this musical moment, jazz funk, you've alluded to it, Mike, where you've got a diverse demographic audience, which is, you know, not typical of music at the time, and maybe not even like a lot of music scenes since, really. And then you've also got the majority of the input being from black artists as well. What do you think has been the impact since of this moment, when there's a lot of African-American artists and black British artists producing music that's being driven into a scene, and then black British audiences are enjoying it? And maybe it didn't last for decades, but there must have been some long-term impacts and consequences of having such a sort of unique moment contextually and musically when jazz funk was happening.
Well, I mean, jazz funk kind of continued on, like, through what we were saying before, the jazz dance scene. It kind of honed in and became more specialist again. So at the All Dayers, the second room would be a jazz room, and all the best dancers would kind of go into that. And out of that came, you know, the next phase was your Giles Peterson and Paul Murphy, you know, these DJs in London as well, alongside what Colin was doing. And acid jazz comes out of that, you know. So it really kind of carried on right through into the 90s in one way or another.
It's as you say, it's all those people have been touched by the jazz funk era, and therefore their decisions musically are still made on a lot of that particular grounding. I mean, jazz in particular. But if you think that, you know, Mike talked about the James Brown, which was, you know, was the North and South thing, really, but Mike proved that it wasn't a North and South thing. But also in came the British bands. We've talked about High Tension, but one of the huge British bands was Atmosphere, of course, that combined, you know, all those things. And then on the back of that, by the time I'm at Berlin, I'm bringing in Fela Kuti, I'm bringing in that African sound, and also the Brazilian sound, bringing in Ed Lincoln. So all these things went into that pot that then people like Giles have fed off with it. Yep. I mean, Giles is probably the single figure that has been able to turn that into a world audience. I mean, you know, what he's achieved and his vision, absolutely phenomenal. Some of it was accidental, some of it wasn't. Yep. But I mean, I think, you know, that certainly opened up all the genres. But when you take all those genres, I think they're all transferable back to a lot of this intelligent music that was made between sort of mid late 70s and the 80s. The integration and the intelligence of the music through this period, I think, is definitely, as we said off mic about the edits that are made today, so many of them go back to that. Whether and sampling, of course, became a massive part with your 45 King onwards, Chad Jackson, who you worked with, and Kenny Dope became a big advocate of that. And now you're seeing DJs nowadays like Darren Jones, who's bringing in that rare aspect of 12 inch singles again, bringing in, you know, like a different vibe, Red Gregg, people like that, where and of course Joey Negro himself, Dave Lee,
and Corollis, have you come across him?
You know, I mean, this isn't at the moment, hasn't been attracting massive audiences, but I've noticed now Darren's been infiltrated into festivals that is now starting to have an impact.
I was going to say, you mentioned, I mean, you've just reeled off a load of examples of the contemporary reiterations of this sound. I mean, if you listen to like a lot of contemporary jazz bands, they are clearly like leaning on a lot of that height, that tempo driven, really interesting rhythmic jazz funk style at the Ezra Collectors.
I think in terms of black music and what we've seen, particularly with club music, is if you think back to the 60s and 70s, record companies were putting in huge amounts of money into certain acts, and there was huge amounts of money going into development of music. And then all of a sudden, DJs were the people making music, and musicians were almost a secondary thought. Mm-hmm. And I think what we are starting to see now is more musicians coming back. I mean, if you look at the current, in the last 4 or 5 years, the current British jazz explosion again with some fantastic artists. Nabil Garcia. I mean, I play a jazz fusion show on every Sunday, which is a combination of jazz, dance and fusion. I'm trying to keep in as many bits to that as I can. I also do separate soul shows and separate house shows. But I think, the artists, and certainly over the last few years, have started to come back. The musicianship has started to come back in, as opposed to just being DJ-made music.
And you guys have obviously contributed to that. You've got your own careers and done your own things, but you've all played a role in that musical trajectory and bringing that really jazz funky sound into Britain and influencing all the people that you have and all the subgenres that you have done. Do you feel aware of that? Like, do you guys feel...
Hell yes.
Yes.
Hell yes.
I mean, people kind of say sometimes, you know, when you hear people say, oh, I had no idea at the time that this would be so important. I remember at Legend on a Wednesday, absolutely knowing this is not happening everywhere. This is a special thing going on. And, you know, all my life, I mean, a lot of the reason that I got into the documentative side and the history side is this wasn't being documented. And these kids that went to these nights, they were the best of them all. They were having such difficulties in their day-to-day life, but they brought this spirit into the clubs. And, you know, they travel.
Let me just mention this here, because I think one of the key things in those days is that crowds followed DJs, right? So my crowd when people came from the northeast and saw what I was doing, next week there'd be a coach load coming down.
Yeah.
And then they booked me to go and do their gig up there. And it just spread across the country like that. I wasn't the only person who was doing it. When the old days started, it was there were coaches coming from everywhere to Clouds, to the ones we had in Blackpool. Yeah. And it's just... it was wonderful.
The Blackpool old days.
I mean, the old days, how they worked was basically it pooled all the main DJs who had the main club nights throughout the North and Midlands. Yeah. I mean, when we talk about the North, it was the North and Midlands, really. Yeah, yeah. And then the Southern scene was almost separate, although they were coming from a similar direction. And, you know, the old day scene was about bringing in all these DJs. So you knew that if you brought in Colin Curtis, there'd be coaches from these places coming down. I'd be bringing my coaches from Wigan and Manchester. Shafty was such a big name on the radio anyway, you know. So that's how it worked, you know. That and these were most Sundays and pretty much every bank holiday Monday.
Somewhere.
That was an all-dayer somewhere. And it was the lineup was... The main DJs, the biggest pulling DJs on the scene, because that's what they needed to do. And what was wonderful about it was it cross-pollinated the scene. So you'd have people coming in from Nottingham, Sheffield, Manchester, Leeds, all coming together. And then they'd find out about each other's clubs. And so you'd see people coming.
That's right. So supporting
in the
local
end,
clubs as
Wigan
well.
Casino, Wigan Pier on a Tuesday, you know, after I'd been there 12, 18 months, the crowd became increasingly black, but drawing from Huddersfield, Sheffield, Manchester, you know, Birmingham. Tuesday night in Wigan. I mean, now when I think back, it's remarkable. Wigan with a very small black population. There were hundreds of black kids on a Tuesday night in Wigan. And what, you know, it must have been a mad thing. And you know, I've told this story many times, but it's a good example of how dedicated this scene was and what this scene was about. But I met some of the guys who used to come up from Birmingham once, and they said the first thing that happened as they got into the car park at Wigan Casino, they siphoned petrol from another car. They only had enough money to get down to the club and get in, but they had to be there. And so they did nick the petrol from another car to get back. They'd pay the 50p or whatever it was to get in the club, and they've made the night out. And it was the same people. I also
to be fair,
heard,
the
like,
cost of petrol to go to a gig now, you might as well, right?
When I did my mixes for Shafty's show on Piccadilly, obviously the kind of listening radio, you know, radius, there were Birmingham kids that would come and drive to Knutsford Services, sit in the car at Knutsford Services, and listen to that show and drive home.
I think that's almost unique to the UK, because you know the underground scenes in the UK that have come out of black music, which is, you know, going back to the 60s and 70s stuff with the Northern Soul, but then you've got the rare groove scene, you've got the funk scene, you know, the jazz scene, you know. A lot of other countries like Japan and Italy have kind of copied off that, because playing these... I mean, I played a record recently in by a Japanese band called Indigo Jam Unit in the Boiler Room session at the festival that we did at Repercussions. I noticed on the YouTube comments somebody actually put, I never thought in my lifetime that I would hear an Indigo Jam Unit record on a Boiler Room set. And I think those barriers are still breakable down. I think I'm not saying that the DJs today aren't on it. Of course, a lot of them are on it. But I think now you've got so many DJs nowadays, thousands and thousands of DJs. Back then it wasn't
everybody's
like that.
A DJ now.
It was a handful of people who were controlling the scene. Not, I don't mean in a controlling fashion, but those people, as Gregor said and as Mike said, coaches would come. People would turn up because your name was on the poster. Not necessarily to individually listen to you, but because that was a quality control.
You were key community figures, right?
Listen, let me just mention this. The other day, no more than a week ago, I'm lying in bed. Don't ask me why. Into my mind comes this song. Do You Get Enough Love by Shirley Jones? Have I got this? Went to my record collection and there it is. That is one of the finest pieces of music ever made. It's not a disco track. It's something that you'd put on a Sunday night in your own house. Or luckily for me, and I know how lucky I was because of it, that's the kind of stuff that I played on a Sunday, mixed in with the jazz funk, in with the funk, mixed in with everything else. People knew they would hear tracks that would live a lifetime.
What a fantastic note to end on from Mike there. I hope you enjoyed listening. I hope you've learned something about the jazz funk era and why it was such a significant moment in the history of British music. Like I said, this kicks off a digital exhibition series where we'll be looking at even more scenes from the North that have had a huge impact on British musical history. So stay tuned for more from the State of the Arts. And remember, you can head to our website and our social media to be up to date with everything going on in arts and culture across the North.